Hello and welcome to the fourth session on the installation and configuration of Commerce Data Exchange Async Service. In the previous sessions, we went through the installation of the Async server itself, configured the Async server and the Async clients within Dynamics AX, and then we installed and validated that our Async clients were also installed properly. In this session, I want to go through how the new Async server data flow works. We're going to run through some scheduling jobs, and we're going to watch the data flow all the way from the AX headquarters down to our two stores that we set up, and then also run a couple transactions in the enterprise POS and watch those pieces of data flow back up into AX headquarters. And in the process, we're going to go through a little bit of troubleshooting and some other things that you should make sure you're concerned with as far as setup goes. Before we start actually running some distribution scheduler jobs to push some data down to our retail channels, I want to take a look at the retail channel schema window. This is takes care of two different things that we had in previous versions of Store Connect and Sync Service. So under Setup, Retail Scheduler, if you go ahead and select Retail Channel Schema, you'll notice that you can define different channel schemas for different versions of our end products. The two different end products being the Enterprise POS, so different versions being 2009, 2012 Feature Pack, etc., and then also our online channel. In 2012 R3, the database schema has actually been combined across all of our channels, so we don't differentiate between the POS and online channel anymore for R3. We just have a single 2012 R3 schema. So this window is replacing the retail channel schema window from previous versions, and you'll also notice that it's replacing the table distribution window from previous versions. Now the table distribution window is a very difficult concept to really understand how it works. We provide you a table distribution for all of the tables that you're probably going to need to replicate down from headquarters to your channels. The only reason that you would need to change anything in the table distribution for a given schema is to push down additional tables or fields that you wish to send to your channels. The retail channel schema window does combine the features from a couple separate windows in previous versions of Store Connect and Sync Service, and then it also adds a little bit of functionality that is unique to R3. The first thing I want to talk about is the table distribution section of this window, which was a separate window in R2 and previous. The table distribution is one of the more difficult concepts to understand as far as the way that Store Connect and Sync Service worked. And the basic concept is that the table distribution will match up tables and link them together as far as the data that needs to be pushed from headquarters to your stores. For instance, if you have one table, maybe the retail terminal table, and maybe if you make a change to the retail terminal table, you want to link some other tables to push that data together, you would link them in the table distribution. The table distribution was only used for AJOBS, AJOBS being the incremental changes, and they were something that would never really be changed. We ship the table distribution with the seed data out of the box. The only time that you need to change table distributions is when you have custom fields or custom tables that you want to replicate to your store databases. In which case, if you do want to take advantage of those tables or fields matching up to other tables, then you would edit the table distribution. In R3, we no longer have a tree view of the table distribution. It was something that didn't really get used very much anyway. If you want to edit the table distribution, which is beyond the scope of this session, what you would do is you would take the text that is in this string field, which is actually a very large field, and you would copy all of that out. It's a XML document. You would take that out and edit it in an XML editor, and then you would paste it back in. So once again, that's something that you would never really have to do unless you have custom fields or custom tables that you want to match up. The other part of this window is discussing, it shows the schema for the different channels that you're going to have. In R3, we do support, we call it N-1 support, which is actually more than just one version behind. We do have the ability to work with 2009 POS, the various versions of 2012 Feature Pack and R2, and then the R2 online channel as well. In R3, the database schema is been unified between the online channel and the enterprise POS. So that's why you won't see an R3 online channel and an R3 POS. For each schema that we have defined, we do have a table distribution that is unique to that schema. And then you'll notice that the schema configuration has a series of data classes. Now these are X++ classes that generate the data and determine how that data is going to be output and uploaded to the async server. In previous versions of the sync service in Store Connect, all of the work that was doing to actually generate the data and generate the classes was done on the fly by the sync service itself. So the sync service would call in based on the data that it thought it needed and would call into the AOS through Business Connector and then generate its data packets that way. In R3, what we've done is we've made it much more specific and we've made it more powerful as far as the X++ code generating the specific jobs, the specific data on the fly with code that's been compiled. So for each of the schemas, you'll see that there are certain amounts of certain different channel classes that have to be created. So you'll notice up at the top there is a Generate Classes button. And anytime that you make changes to the schema of your channel, which again is pretty rare, we do ship the out-of-the-box schema, and the only time you would really need to do that is if you did custom fields or tables. You would need to generate the classes. And the Generate Classes does a couple things. It goes through the table distribution, and it goes through all of the jobs that you have set up and the subjobs and all of the fields that are matched with your jobs and subjobs, and it will generate these X++ classes. It'll compile them and it'll do the CIL incremental. And the other thing that it will do is it will actually go out and mark any table that you have in a subjob as SQL change tracking directly within SQL. And I'm going to show you a little bit how that works. So the first thing that you'll have to do before you run any of your scheduler jobs is go through this Generate Classes. Now the Generate Classes does take quite a while, so I'm going to go ahead and kick that off and then I'll pause the recording and show you what it did after that. The one thing that I want to show you in SQL before we kick that off is this is a standard SQL query that is looking at the change tracking tables. So I have this pointed at our Microsoft Dynamics AX database, and I want to show that there are no tables that are currently being change tracked in our Microsoft Dynamics AX database. So I ran that query, you can see that it returned an empty result set. After the generate classes has been run, this will go through the same query. You'll see we'll have some tables that are now being tracked. So I'm going to go ahead and kick that off, and then that will take some time. And when it's done, you should see that the CIL completed properly. And if we were to look in our AOT, we would see that these classes were generated in the user layer, because that's what we are logged in as. Now we can go over and take a look that we should have gotten our SQL stuff, our SQL change tracking turned on for those tables. And you'll see that it is indeed any subjob that we have a table related to that we're going to replicate data from headquarters down to our stores to is now being tracked with SQL change tracking. Back on our retail channel schema window, I did want to show you one other thing. In previous versions, the way that we would bring in our tables that we were allowed to edit and modify and add to subjobs was to go in and read the table schema for one of our channel databases. For instance, in R2, if you went to the similar window with the location tables, there was a button on there that said read schema. And what that would do is it would send a special packet down to Store Connect. Store Connect would go into the POS database that you have defined for that particular location, and it would read all of the tables and fields from SQL. And it would take those the definitions of those tables and fields and send them back up into AX, and that's where the location tables would be defined so that when you went into your subjob editor, you'd be able to select which tables map to each other and ultimately what fields map to each other. In R3, we still have the location tables. So based on our table distribution that we want to track, we should have a list of tables that are going to ultimately end up in our POS database or our channel database. This is now manually editable. We found that this was changed so very little and was something you don't have to do very often. So it's just as easy to go in and manually edit these. So when you go ahead and create a new table or field in your POS database, what you can do is you can go in here and edit. And then for each table or table that is in your POS channel database, you can go into your location fields. And all this does is define the fields that are in that table at the channel database, and those fields then are able to be mapped in our subjobs. So you'll notice there is no read schema in this window anymore. The jobs and subjobs windows are very similar to what they were in R2 and previous. We'll take a quick scan through those. The scheduler subjobs has been simplified a little bit, and you do have a subjob. We changed the naming of the subjobs for R3 to be just exactly what the tables are, so we've simplified that quite a bit. Then for all the jobs, you define whether or not those are going to be push jobs or pull jobs. In R3, we call those download jobs for data that is being pushed out, and upload jobs for things that are going to be pushed up from your channel database. If you remember correctly, for the P jobs, we had to create the temporary tables, so we had the create staging tables. If you get to a subjob that has been marked as a pull data, then you have to create that staging table. For outgoing jobs, the transfer field list is very similar to what it was before. You do have the ability to have different field names or even different table names between your headquarters and your channel databases. So this is largely unchanged. The mapping that is done between the tables, between your POS or your channel database, is defined here, and then the AX version of that table, which is read just from your X++ AOT, is defined here. We do have some tables that have different names in AX than they are in the channel database. The other nice thing about this window, and I think we had this in the previous version as well, is if you have a subjob, you are able to determine which job has that subjob in use. One other thing I was going to mention about the table mappings, the channel table name is, this drop down is from that table mappings window that we had in the retail schema. So if the table does not exist there, then you won't be able to select it for a table that you want to map to the AX headquarters. And I'm just going to zip down and pick a table to show you a push job. And those would traditionally be the retail transaction tables. So if we take the sales transaction table, you'll see that it is a pull data instead of a push data. So this is going to be scheduled by a P job. And you'll see that since we have selected one that is a pull data, that the create staging table button is enabled. Similar to the scheduler subjobs, the scheduler jobs definition window is largely unchanged with R2 and previous versions of Store Connect. We still have the ability to group subjobs together. So in here you can select a job that you want and then which subjobs are comprised of that. The schema is available so you can actually select different versions of the retail channel schema if you do want to do N-1 support. Again, the N-1 support is beyond the scope of this session. The P job itself is defined of a large number of jobs, subjobs, and you can create staging tables for all of the subjobs that are in that particular P job. So we actually did that in one of the earlier sessions. Now, for those who have worked with previous versions of Store Connect and Sync Service, I haven't really gone into too much detail yet, but I've made a couple hints about it. You'll be very excited to see that all of the jobs are no longer broken down with an A and an N in front of that. The reason for that is that A jobs and N jobs are gone. We have removed them from the system. No longer are you forced to determine whether or not you want to replicate tables by full data sync, which was what an end job was before, or by incremental data sync, which is what A jobs were before. It was very difficult to come up with a system of full data sync and incremental data sync. Trying to switch from end jobs to A jobs was difficult. Also, there was advantages of A jobs that were not available for end jobs. For instance, you could not segregate data very easily with end jobs in previous versions. The only way you could do that was with A jobs, so that A jobs were what used the table distributions. The nice thing about the way that jobs work in R3 is we do have that full data segregation from the get-go. As soon as you run any job that tries to replicate data from the headquarters down to a channel database, it will go through the table distribution and match up based on which channels are mapped to the job that we're running for. It will actually go down and segregate that data, so it will only send the subset of data that's necessary for that particular location that you're sending it to. The other nice thing is that since the jobs are combined, the first time that you run a job, it will determine whether or not a full data sync has to be run for a particular destination, or if a full data sync has already been run for a destination, it will determine whether or not an incremental sync is all that needs to be done. So in other words, the jobs in R3 take the place of both the N and the A jobs. This is a very, very simplified way of sending data, and because we're taking advantage of the SQL change tracking, it's very much easier to implement and maintain. Other than the fact that the A jobs and the N jobs have been combined, as mentioned, the scheduler job window itself has been largely unchanged with R3. There are a couple different ways that you will be able to synchronize data from your headquarters down to your channel databases. The first way is the full data sync, which can be done from a data group or a channel database. And I'll show you the differences between those two in a minute. And then the other way is to do your periodic scheduling jobs. The periodic scheduling job is very similar to what it was in R2 and previous versions. And we'll go through that second. So the first thing we're going to do is we'll review how we have our system set up. If you remember correctly, we created one channel data group for our two stores. And we assigned both Houston and Seattle to this data group. When you run a data group, when you combine stores into the same data group, a couple things happen. The first thing is that those stores that are in that data group are what are used for the segregation of the data. So anytime that you run a job that has a table distribution associated with it, the first thing that it'll do is it'll go through the channel databases that are assigned to the data group, and it'll see which channels are associated with that data group. It will then, when it determines which data it needs to pull from the headquarters database, it'll go through and make sure that it does a join against just these channel databases, and it will only pull the data that's associated with those channel databases. The next thing that'll happen is it will create a single package file. The only thing that the headquarters is responsible for is creating that package file. It has no responsibility at all for determining whether or not the channels pulled that data file down. Its only job when it runs a database scheduler job or a full data sync is to generate that RPF file. The way that the system has been changed is that it is the responsibility of the async clients to periodically go and grab that data. So it is very much more of a disconnected system, and the onus is very much on the channels themselves to be responsible for pulling down that data. The nice thing about this is that in previous versions, there were some cases once in a while where trying to push data down through all of the stores, one store, if it was became in a disconnected state, could potentially affect another store. So if you have stores that sometimes have bad network connections, there was the potential for both download and upload jobs to have that connectivity affect other stores. So one of the goals that we had with the R3 async service was to split that up so that the headquarters could always just push data to the async server, and then all the async clients were responsible for getting that data. When you run a full data sync for a channel data group, you do have the ability to select any of those distribution schedules that we have defined in our distribution scheduler window, or you can select from the all jobs schedule. So what this does is it goes through and for all the jobs that you have scheduled as part of this 9999 schedule, it will go in and run all of the jobs that are part of that schedule. And for all of those jobs, it will run all the subjobs. So the first time that you bring up to speed a new channel data group, so a group of stores that you want to push data from, you would go in here and you would select the distribution schedule 9999 and execute that. You will have the ability to either execute it immediately, or you can throw it on a batch process as well if you want to schedule that out. So you can push that to a specific batch server if you like. One thing that's very important to note when you're running jobs either with the full data sync or even in the scheduler window is in previous versions, whenever you ran a job, the only thing that actually happened was a request was made at the store connect or sync service to execute that job when it came up on its queue. In R3, the X++ code is actually responsible for generating that data. So if you do a run now, you might have the client actually spend the next 5 or 10 or 15 minutes executing the jobs that generate that data and then ultimately generating the package file for that data. So you'll really want to be more careful about running those jobs manually. If you have a session open inside AX, it'll freeze that session until the job is complete, and it'll look like not responding, etc. The good side about this is that once the AX client tells you that the job is successful or not, that means that the package file has been created, and you don't have to worry about another process later failing to generate that data, as you might have had in Store Connect or Sync Service. Before we run the full data sync for the four nines, I do want to just do a full data sync on a group of tables so I can show you how the RPF files are generated. So we're going to do the full data sync on the currency tables for these two channel databases, or this channel data group actually. So I'm going to go ahead and hit OK, and we'll run that right now. You'll notice that the X++ code did take a little bit to generate that file, and then it was ultimately successful. So let's take a look at a couple of the things that it did there. First thing is, you'll notice in our CDX downloads directory, we now have a subfolder. As I mentioned earlier, you can have one CDX download directory that's shared by multiple data groups, and the X++ code is smart enough to actually generate subfolders for that data group. The subfolder is named based on the rec ID of that data group. So if we go into that subfolder, you'll see that an RPF file was generated. The RPF file is pretty much the same data format that we had for the package files in previous versions. This is a set of XML files that we generate that we then zip up into a single file, and then the file is what's downloaded by the async clients. We do have a tool in the async client to view these files. So I will go ahead and open one of those up, and we'll take a look at that RPF file. So what I've done is I've cheated, and I've mapped out to my async client machine, and I've gone into the package folder. You'll notice that there's a ddpackview.executable, and this is actually the same pack viewer that we had in previous versions. And it's pretty simple to use. You go out and you look at one single file, and then it'll suggest a folder that it will extract things to automatically for you. And if you hit open folder before you convert, it'll go ahead and convert those files and open the file folder for you within Windows Explorer. So you'll see that we have a single file called SC target request header, and this is the table that is basically the action of what's going to happen at the channel database. So it will define whether or not a a complete deletion of all the records has to be done, or if this is just going to be an insert or update or delete statement for incremental. In this case, I happen to know that since we did a full data sync, that it's going to actually delete all the records for these four tables at the destination. The other four tables themselves are just XML representations of the data that's going to be sent to the channel. So that's the data that the sync or the async client will use to import into the channel database. So the X++ code within AX is what generated the RPF file. It also does one very other important thing, and that is it will upload the information about that RPF file into the message HQ message database. Specifically, what it'll do is it will create a download session record pointing to that RPF file, mentioning exactly which job was resulting of it, and it'll do a checksum of the XML file itself. There'll also be records placed in the download session data store table based on the channels that are part of that data group. So based on the databases that are part of that data group, these are the async clients then that are responsible for downloading those RPF files. And you'll notice that there is a status and a try count for that message. So that particular RPF file is set up to be downloaded by our two channel databases. And the reason for that is because we have the channel databases in the same data group. If we had set up a data group for each of those two channel databases, we would just have one for each data group in here. Now I've actually turned off the async clients on both of my store machines, so these messages are sitting out here ready to be downloaded. The next thing I want to show you guys is inside AX, how the monitoring of those messages works. In previous versions of Store Connect and Sync Service, you may have been used to doing the monitoring of your Store Connect or Sync Service by doing SQL queries against the message database. The goal with the new way of doing things is to try and minimize the amount of message database direct queries that you want. There was some monitoring that happened with Store Connect and Sync Service before, but basically what happened was whenever the Sync Services tried to do something with a particular message, it would periodically call home using the real-time service up into AX, and it would update the status of that message if there was an error or something like that. And it wasn't necessarily real-time. The nice thing about putting everything in a centralized message database and making that message database the master record keeper of everything that's happening is we can do a real-time look into that database tables for all of our sessions directly from within AX. And that is done by looking at our three inquiry windows under Commerce Data Exchange, the async server connection status, the download sessions, and the upload sessions. So we'll take a look at the download sessions, and we'll see that the RPF file that we did generate got added based on our channel data group of West and then our two channel databases. And we'll see that it says that it started. So this means that the records have been started, they've been the package has been created, and they're sitting there ready to be downloaded. You'll also see that there is a location of the download path and then the number of rows that were affected, the number of rows that we have inside that data package. From within the download sessions window, you also have the ability to rerun a particular job. If for some reason that package was not able to be downloaded, or if there was a database problem at the destination, you could mark this as a rerun. And basically what that'll do is the next time that a particular async client calls home, it will basically be notified that this package file, which is still sitting out there, has the ability and should be rerun at the channel database. So the async client then is directed to re-download that package and try to reapply it. Now the RPF files and these messages themselves stay around as long as they are defined in our client, our sync service configuration window. And that's what we set up in a previous session. under our parameters window, the retail scheduler parameters. One thing of note about the two windows that are used for the download sessions and upload session inquiry windows, I said that there is a real-time view into the message database for those windows, and that's not entirely accurate. There's actually a little trick that we do behind the scenes. Trying to put disparate data into an X++ form is a very difficult thing to do. If you remember correctly, the message database is a SQL table or a SQL database that we communicate from within AX via pass-through SQL. And doing that to populate an X++ form is very difficult. So what we actually do is we have change tracking itself turned on at the message HQ database. And that message database will periodically synchronize into X++ tables. Now, there's two ways that that happens. The periodic part of it will happen whenever a download session occurs. So whenever a scheduler job runs a download session, the X++ scheduler will go out and try to synchronize any new records in those message databases for the monitoring purposes into the X++ tables. You also have the ability to perform a process status messages. And what a process status messages does is it goes out and does that manually. So you could set this up as a batch if for some reason, for instance, if you have your scheduler jobs running at strange intervals and you want to try and make sure that the scheduling, the status messages are updated in the view for AX window, you could go in here and set this up to process as often as possible, maybe every half hour, maybe every 10 minutes. So if you're finding that your status messages are not being updated based on the jobs that are running, you can go in here and run this job manually, and it will go and do a manual synchronize based on change tracking. And I'm actually going to show that because we are going to turn on our async clients, have them process the messages. And since we don't have our scheduler set up to run download jobs right now on our batch server, we'll want to go through that manual process to process the status messages so that we can see what they look like inside our AX window. The next window I want to show you is the async server connection status. Oh, before I go there, I do want to show you might have noticed this on the download sessions window. You can also process status messages directly from within here as well. So the async server connection status is a very simple window, but it's very, very powerful. This is a great window for you to get a very quick glance at your entire async ecosystem. And what happens here is that anytime an async client will, what I call phone home, anytime that it connects to its async server to determine whether or not it needs to upload new messages or download messages, it'll just do a quick little entry into a database table that says this was the last time I connected and checked to see if I had anything to do. So this particular async client has not run for a little while. I have these currently turned off, and I have them set up to run every minute, so you can see based on my time here that they haven't run for quite some time. This is a perfect table that you would want to set up some sort of alert system. So if you have a channel database that hasn't connected to an async server for maybe 24 hours, and you have that async client set up to talk to the async server every hour, you might want to have something that sends out an alert that says this particular async client hasn't talked to the async server in a while, so you could notify somebody of that. So now that we have a couple of RPF files that are ready to be downloaded by async clients, I want to go into those server machines that we have set up for our stores and start up our async client. So I've opened up a remote desktop into the Seattle store, and all I'm going to do is I'm going to kick off the async client. And the first thing that the async client does when it starts up is it will immediately contact its async server and ask if there's anything that needs to be downloaded. So it'll initiate two things. It'll initiate an upload session, so it will determine if anything needs to be uploaded, and it'll do so. And it'll also ask for a download session to see if there's any RPF files waiting to be processed. Now, one of the things that has happened that we get requests for since R3 first came out, and it's one of the first things I asked about, was we're very accustomed to, when you do a run job inside AX at the headquarters, to be assured that that data is going to be pushed down all the way to the POS database. And sometimes this is important if you have a egregious price mistake that needs to be pushed down to your clients. You don't want to wait for the async client to check every 4 hours whether or not there's a new package to download. Unfortunately, with the new system, you do have to wait for that 4 hours to process. So if you don't have any view into the store, anytime you push one of those jobs down and you only have async clients set up to pull jobs every 4 hours, there's no way that you can say from within AX, I need this data to get down to the store right away. The only workaround on that, and it's not a terribly difficult workaround, is to just restart the async client. So anytime that you recycle the async client Windows service, it'll immediately go down and go up and download that job and apply that package file to the store database. Now, if you use the System Center modules that are packaged with R3, you have an even bigger advantage. Rather than having to call a store manager and walk them through recycling their Windows service, you can actually do that in a centralized way. Just set up all of your stores and cycle all of the async clients manually that way. So now that we have the async client up and running here for a little bit, let's go back to our AX and we'll process our status messages because we haven't run any jobs since then. And we'll see if that package file got downloaded by the Seattle store. You'll see that the Seattle store actually did go ahead and connect to the async server, so we know that the async client is able to connect and at least initiate an upload and a download session. It was able to phone home successfully. And if we go into our download sessions, hopefully that RPF file has been downloaded. And indeed it has. The message that we're looking for is apply, and it was successful. It tells us how many rows were affected for the push. Sometimes, just as in previous versions, that 565 might show as a doubled value. If you are running an initial data sync, then it will delete rows and reinsert them. And it'll give us some additional information about that package file. The Houston database, since I haven't started that service up, the Houston database just has that RPF file still sticking around, and when it's good and ready to download that RPF file, it will go ahead and grab that RPF file and hopefully apply itself as well. Now, the RPF files are not actually deleted based on the number of days that they stick around until all of the clients have successfully downloaded and applied that package. Now we can go and take a look at that currency file. I'll go ahead and pause this and fire up SQL Enterprise Manager, and we'll make sure that the insert actually was done into the POS database. So on the Seattle POS machine, I've just launched a SQL query, and we'll just take a look at one of those four tables. And you can see that indeed we do have the data that was replicated up. So that's how you do an initial data sync on a scheduler job at the group level. One thing that might come up when you are running your stores is you might bring a third store online in a particular group. Now there's no reason that you can't generate a full data sync against all of the stores that are part of that group, all the channels that are part of that group. In which case, whenever you go in and bring up that data group, you can do the full data sync and an RPF file will be generated for all the stores, and it'll perform a complete data refresh for all the stores. But in some cases, you might not want to actually send that much data down. If you have a data group system set up so that you have very many channel databases in each group, that might be a lot more data than you really want to send down. In that case, you can actually do the same thing directly from the channel database itself. So for instance, if we added a third database of San Francisco here, you could do a full data sync just on that particular database, and you could use the exact same distribution schedules that you would like there. In that case, the same RPF file will be generated, but on the table inside the message database that tells which channel databases are supposed to download that file, only that particular database will be marked for an async client to download it. So the other async clients will just phone home, see the file is not for them, and will ignore that file. Moving over to the distribution schedule window itself, this will look very similar to those of you who have used the distribution scheduler in previous versions. The jobs are the same that were previously in other versions, except for mentioning, I previously mentioned that the A jobs and N jobs have been combined. The AOS connection profile here is just used for N-1 support, so we're not going to be using that in this particular session. When you schedule a job to run, you schedule the job to run for a particular data group, one or more data groups. So since I have cleared out all my data, I don't have any data groups for the scheduler. So if I want to run the 1000 job, I might want to select that one to go to my West data group. If you want to have different schedules for different jobs, all you have to do is make copies of the 1000 and maybe call it 1000A, 1000B, 1000C, and you could have those set up as different batch jobs, and then you could have those set up to go to different groups as well. And then underneath that are the actual scheduler jobs that are associated with it. The scheduler jobs are usually named the same as the job themselves, but you can name them anything that you want. Underneath the scheduler jobs, there's also that is up at the top. There's a history window telling you when exactly that particular job was run. In this case, you can see that we ran that 1000 job already as part of our full data sync. And you do have a nice little view into the download session for those channel databases too, so you can see at a glance who's downloaded that and applied those. To set up a particular job as a scheduled batch, you just select that job and you tell it to create the batch, and you go through the standard batch processing setup that you would in AX for any other batch job. You can also do a run now for a scheduler. Once again, the scheduled job, if you do a run now, could freeze your AX client, because rather than just sending that request to the store connect or sync service, it is actually going to do the entire job of generating that generating that RPF file, and it won't return control to the AX client until that RPF file has been generated. So when a job gets run from the distribution schedule window, it will first check against the SQL change tracking to determine which records need to be replicated for that particular job. I'm going to go through a little bit of that to show you what you can check for in that. But the nice thing about this is that if for some reason a job is being run that the SQL change tracking has not been set up for, it will determine, or if the SQL change tracking has expired for that particular scheduled job, it will actually do a full data sync from here as well. So the nice thing about this is that you don't even have to do a full data sync from your distribution group. As soon as you run a 1000 job or a 1010 job or a 1020 job, and it determines that it doesn't have any SQL change tracking that's relevant from the last time that you ran this job, it will go ahead and give you a warning and say the data changes related to the scheduler job and this data group are no longer available, so all data will be sent instead. So it's kind of a fail-safe mechanism that we have that will only go and do that incremental data tracking or data generation if it feels that it's safe to do so. So let's go ahead and run that 1000 job, our currency job, against West, and we'll see if it actually has anything to do. And you'll see that we indeed have the change tracking information related to this scheduler are only partially available, so it will do a complete snapshot of the data instead. Now, this probably should have picked up the fact that when we did that full data sync that it should have set up the change tracking, but sometimes that's not always the case. In fact, it might always be best to do, instead of doing the full data sync from within the data group, to just go ahead and run a scheduler job. Because what this is telling us is that it's generated another RPF file with all of the data for that. So at this point in time, the incremental changes should be going forward from there. And we can actually go look at our folder, and you can see that it did generate a new RPF file, and it's the same size as the other one. So we can assume that that's the same snapshot of data that's going down. We can also check to see if we happen to catch that in the single minute, since I have Seattle going every minute, whether or not that was picked up yet. And it hasn't been picked up yet. So we can do our process status messages, and then we can see that it has been picked up. So the Seattle has gone through and done another full data sync of those four tables for us. Now this is where the cool stuff starts to kick in. If we run that job again, we can see if an RPF file is generated. And in this case it was. So it looks like I have something incorrectly set up here. I'll do a little bit of research on that and pause the recording while I check that out. The problem here is that we have not actually had much activity in the SQL change tracking, so things haven't really kicked in yet, if you will. This probably won't be an issue in a real-life scenario because there'll be more activity on the tables. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a change in the currency table and hopefully have that kick in the change tracking. So I'm just going to make a silly little change to one of these and just add a symbol to some of these different currencies that aren't there. So we made two changes to the currency table. Hopefully then that when we run our job and we still have the same issue, but I'm going to try it one more time and I'm going to show you guys where in the tables this is coming from. We'll see if it tries it one more time. And it did succeed now without doing the full sync instead of the incremental sync. And I'm going to show you guys how that works, but first let's take a look at that RPF file. And you'll see it actually did not generate an RPF file for that one. The two changes that we made while it was before the SQL change tracking had really kicked in were part of that last full data sync that happened on the last one. So let's try one more time to make another change to a currency and run the scheduler one more time and see if we get a RPF file that consists of just those two changes. And we did. So you'll see we have the 1120-R RPF file. And if we were to open that up in our little viewer, you'll see that it has still our header record, but in our currency table, it just has our two records that were changed. So when this gets downloaded then by our async client for those two channels, it will know that it only has to do an insert of those two records or an update of those two records rather than a full data sync again. So from this point on, as long as the SQL change tracking against those tables has not grown stale, and I'll show you what that means in a second, as long as the AX system has determined that that has not grown stale, it will continue just to do incremental packages instead of full data packages. Every time that a change is made to a table that is being tracked with SQL change tracking, SQL will keep track of some key information about that particular table in one of its own system tables. And then it will keep track of how stale those records are. When you set up in SQL the SQL change tracking, you have the ability to determine how long it should keep that information. So by default, that's for 2 days inside SQL. And then there's also a determination of whether you want that to automatically clean up. Obviously, keeping track of too much information for too long of a time will result in huge amounts of data. So you'll want to definitely figure out what the sweet spot is for how long you want the change tracking to keep things around. And part of that will be determined by how often you synchronize data from within AX, the size of the data that you synchronize from within AX. There's lots of inputs that will go into that decision. So SQL uses that retention period to determine whether or not data is stale or not. And if you were to look at that query that we had earlier, You'll see that there is a value called the minimum valid version and some other information about the particular tables that are being tracked. So the minimum valid version here is what AX will look at when it runs its scheduler job to determine if the value is stale or not. And if it's too far back, if for instance AX thinks that it needs to go back to version 40 of a particular table, this table might say, well, the minimum valid version I have is 50, then AX will determine that it just needs to do a full data sync on that table. So that's where the smart logic comes in with AX. The way that AX then stores what the version is for a group of tables is in the retail CDX data sync row version table. And this isn't something that you'll see in AX necessarily. It's a behind the scenes kind of table. But if we look at this, this is how we are determining what is the most recent data that has been sent to the async clients for all of the databases in this data group. So there's two keys to this table, the data group and the job ID. So we track the row version based on those two pieces of information. Since there could be different data going to different data groups, this will be different for each data group. And then all the tables will, in a particular job, will share the same row version. This is because row version is shared amongst all the change tracked tables. So the row version here will be the oldest record of all the four tables. So we know at this point in time that any change that has been made up through version 4 of any of our four tables that are in the currency table, the currency job, that we have replicated everything through row 4 or through change number 4. If we were to make a change to one of those other tables besides the actual currency table, that would start with row 5. And or with change number 5 and go on and so forth. So 4, 5, 6, and 7. The row version is shared amongst all the tables that are being tracked. So when you run a job from the scheduler or when the batch process runs this job, it'll go and track and see that we have sent data all the way down from row version 4. If we were to make another change to our currency, we can actually see all the changes that are made to that currency table by looking at the change table function, which is a SQL system function available. So we have new changes that were made to the table, syschange version 5 and 6, and you can see we actually have some key information on the table. So our key information for the currency table is partition and currency code, so that uniquely identifies the record that was changed. And then we also have some information about the changed columns. The scheduler doesn't actually use the changed columns. It will actually send down an entire record. So we're just after the key value information. But you can see here that it's also an update change operation. So when the scheduler runs, it will go in into our SQL Retail CDX rows version, see that we only have changes up through 4, and then it will go through and execute one of these statements against the four tables. So currency is the only table I'm changing. And it will determine which records have changed. And then it will create an X++ statement to go grab information about 4 or 5 and 6. So it will say, give me the record for the AUD currency and the BMD currency. And that's the RPF file that I'm going to generate that will contain those two records. So that, in a very brief nutshell, is how the AX scheduler will work with the SQL change tracking to figure out which new delta records need to be sent down, which incremental records need to be sent down. So with that quick little overview of how SQL change tracking interacts, I'm going to actually get all of my retail scheduler jobs going and fire up all of my distribution schedules for that particular data group. And I'll run the jobs, and then I'm going to validate that everything went down and hopefully be able to log into my POS. At that point in time, I'll run a couple transactions, and then we'll be able to work with some PJobs to push that data back up into AX. So I've gone ahead and let all of the scheduler jobs finish processing, and I've gone through and did my process status messages. If you remember correctly, the process status messages gets done every time that we run a job. But if you don't have jobs set up to run periodically through your batch, you would want to run the jobs and then come back and do the process status messages periodically just to check out what the status was of all of those download sessions. So as you can see, I went ahead and let those finish. My status equals applied on all of those, and you can see it sent down the data to both the Seattle and the Houston databases. So I've already gone in to the POS, but under my Seattle store, I'll go ahead and launch the POS again. And we'll go ahead and just log in and do a couple transactions, and we'll talk about how PJobs work. The Enterprise POS is very similar to what it was between R2 and R3. There's some new functionality that we've added, but by and large, the product is very similar. So I've gone ahead and logged in, and I have a session already open. So I will go ahead and add a couple items, and we'll just do some pay cash exact on those. And we'll go ahead and just log off and close out the POS. So we've gone and done a couple logins. We've added our shift. We created a shift. We did a couple transactions. So at this point in time, in R2 and previous with Store Connect and Sync Service, we would be able to create those transactions and then pull them back into AX just by running the PJob. In R3, just as the download jobs were disconnected into two steps, the upload jobs are also disconnected into or changed into two steps. So if we were to run the PJob at this point in time, we've got a couple problems. The first thing is that the PJob in R3 no longer goes directly to the channel database to pull transactions. In R2 and previous, what would happen is the AX would take a status of all of the transactions that it had uploaded from a particular channel. It would do this by looking at the highest replication counter from origin on all the tables that were being brought up. And it would send down a request to the Store Connect or Sync service at the channel that says, give me all the records in the retail transaction table that have a replication counter of 35 or higher. And then when it came in and brought in those transactions, we'll say 35 through 42, the next time that it ran a PJob, it would know that has all the records up to 42, and would say, give me all the records 43 and higher. In R3, that process has been changed into a distinct two-step process. When you run the PJob inside AX, the only thing that happens is the AX X++ code will go out to the async server message database and see if there are any RPF files that have been uploaded by the async client. And if there are some RPF files that are sitting there ready to be processed, it will read the RPF files and bring them into AX staging tables. And then from the temporary staging tables, it would go directly into the AX version of the transaction tables. Notice that when I said that it only goes out to the message database to see any RPF files that have been uploaded, that means that the AX scheduler is no longer the master of the process, meaning it does not have control over what transactions get uploaded and when they get uploaded. All of that is put out on the async client to decide that information. So the AX client, when it runs a scheduler job, all it's doing is seeing if there's anything that's been uploaded from an async client that hasn't yet been brought into AX. The next question you might ask is, if we are setting our async clients to upload every so often, and if you remember correctly, we set up our async clients in our retail async server profile to do 1 minute downloads and 1 minute uploads. Now my Seattle async client is running and it should be checking to upload files every minute, just like it checks to download RPF files every minute. However, if we were to look in our RPF files directory, you'd see that we do not have any transactions uploaded yet. The upload directory is completely empty. And we would expect here that since we have some transactions that we ran inside the POS, that we should be getting files. Now, this is a tricky thing. It took me a little while to figure out what was going on here as to why my upload jobs were not providing any data into the async server. And the reason for that is we have to add a particular channel to an AP job in order for it to be triggered to start uploading transactions. So if you look here, we don't have any data groups that have been assigned to any AP jobs. So this means that since the Seattle and Houston are in one data group, that data group has not yet been assigned to any AP jobs. So when either of those async clients phone home to see if I need to upload any transactions, they will first look in async server into one of the async server tables in the message database, and it'll look at that and say, well, I don't belong to any AP jobs, so I don't want to upload any data since I don't have any way to process that data in AX anyway. So there's a two-step process to correct that. I'm going to go ahead and stop the Seattle async client just to show you how things work here. And we will add the Seattle and Houston to our AP job. And remember, those are part of our West data group. And after we make any changes to our distribution schedule or really anything in our async ecosystem, we need to make sure that that information gets synced with our message database. And as you remember, I mentioned earlier, the sync metadata happens in two places. It happens the next time you run a job. So if our batch scheduler was set up to run any kind of job, a download job or an upload job, the information that we just added by changing the channel data group for this P job to West would have gotten synchronized to our metadata on our message database. Or we can make that happen manually by going to our retail scheduler parameters and doing the sync metadata. Now, that does one very important thing inside our message database, and I probably should have showed you this table before I ran the sync metadata. Inside the channel database, or excuse me, the message database, there is a schedule job table. And what this does is it tells us which schedule, which P job has things assigned to it. So when we see that the P001 job has been added to the schedule job, this is telling the message database that the P0001 job exists and there might be something to do for an async client. There's also a table called just job, and we actually show the definition of this job. Now, this is hidden and it's a construct that we don't really make it too readable, but what this job is saying here for the ID of P0001 is that the two channel databases of Seattle and Houston are part of this job. Once again, it's not really something you can see very useful here, but there's information about the channels that are part of this job. So what happens then, now when the async client phones home up to the async server, it'll look at this table, the async server will look at this table and see if the async client that's being requesting to upload data exists in any P job that wants that data. So now when we fire up our async client, we should be able to see some data start processing through. So I'm going to go ahead and back to my Seattle store and fire up the async client, and that'll automatically initiate both an upload and a download session. That's the first thing that it does. So if we look at our directory now, you'll see that we do have a Seattle DBID folder that was created, and hopefully there'll be an RPF file. So the RPF file then is all of the transactions that the async client decided that needed to be uploaded to AX. We could also take a look at these RPF files directly within our package viewer. For some reason, it does not tell us, it doesn't update this with the upload automatically. So we'll try this and see if it can create the folder for us. It also does not go to the directory we want it to. But you'll see that it does create our package viewer file here, and you'll see that we have the XML files. Once again, the header describing all of the tables that are have payload data in them. And then you'll see that these are the transaction tables that are part of the POS. So we do have the retail transaction table, some tax information, the sales lines, and then also the payment information. So now that we have an RPF file sitting out here, when the async client initiated the upload session, it also created some records in our message database at the headquarters. And this is telling AX that there is a new RPF file that's been uploaded. Here is the information about who uploaded that RPF file. And there's a status in there that says this RPF file has been uploaded, but it hasn't been imported into AX. So now when we run our pjob, this will automatically go out directly to the message database because AX does not talk directly to async server. AX just goes directly to the message database and it queries the upload session table for any jobs that were uploaded that have not been imported yet. So we'll go ahead and run that. Now, if we go into our retail transactions inquiry window, we should be able to sort by date. And you can see that indeed we do have some transactions that were brought in from the scheduler. We should have some login information, and then we should have a concluded transaction for the transaction that we created. Log on, log on, log off. There's our sales. We voided one. Log off, log on, sales. There we go. There's our sales here. And you can see that we had our 001 item, our 002 item. And we should have a payment on there for cash. And that is there. Now, the upload session also provides a logging mechanism at the inquiry window. So this will have the identifier of the RPF file, the session number, and more importantly, the channel database. And then it will also tell us how many rows were affected. Once again, the biggest change here, similar to the download sessions, is that the async client is the master of what's going to happen here as far as the data initiation of the push and pull of the data. There are basically two timers that come into play with both the upload and the download jobs. In previous versions, the only timers that ever came into play were the timers that you had set up on your batch processes. So you would have your batches set up if you wanted a particular end job to run every half hour, or if you wanted a particular P job to run every 15 minutes. Those would actually initiate the entire process. So it would push all the data down to the store databases if it could, and then likewise it would go all the way into the store databases and pull out transactions. Both of these have been split out into two schedulers then. So the scheduler for the batch job still remains. You can tell it to run an outgoing job every half hour or every 2 hours. And you could tell it to pull in transactions every 15 minutes or every half hour. But the only thing that happens is it will only send the messages or pull the messages from the async server. So it will only be able to push databases to the async server's RPF download directory, and it will only be able to pull transactions from the RPF upload directory. It's dependent on the async client at the store level to actually do the work from there. Now, the store level has their own scheduler then. So aside from however often you run the P jobs or the outgoing jobs, it's up to the async client to define how often either those RPF files are pulled down from the async server or how often it wants to upload to the async server. So even if you have a P job, for instance, that runs every 15 minutes inside AX, you might have your stores set up to only upload transactions every 4 hours. They might be on different schedules. You might have some stores that upload every hour. You might have some stores that only update every 12 hours, for instance, twice a day. The P job inside AX will still go out and check for any uploaded files every 15 minutes, but there's no way for AX to try and go down to that store that's only uploading every 12 hours, for instance, and ask for transactions immediately. As was the case with the download jobs, the workaround for that, if you really need to get transactions immediately into AX, is to simply recycle the Windows service for the async client. Remember that the async client will initiate an upload session and a download session immediately upon startup. So if you do have some means to be able to cycle those Windows services remotely, that's your best bet on being able to move data quickly if you need to. Now, one thing that comes up, because we are no longer allowing AX to dictate which transactions get uploaded into the AX database, the natural question might come back to, well, how does AX know which records it needs to upload? As I mentioned in previous versions, AX was in charge of asking for certain records. So if it knew that it had the records 0 through 33 of the retail transaction sales trans, it would send a request for records 34 and higher. Well, that's no longer possible to do. The async client now has to be in charge of figuring out which records to upload to AX. So that's a pretty big change. Luckily, it's pretty easy to determine how that works. What we have done is we've created a new table within the channel database, and it's in charge of keeping track of which records belong to which packet. So for instance, I've gone ahead and behind the scenes, I've uploaded a couple more transactions and did a couple more jobs, excuse me, a couple more cycles of my async client. So I'm going to go ahead and run that P job, and I'll show you how that looks inside that table that I'm talking about. So I'll go ahead and run the P job, and we'll see if our upload sessions worked properly. So you'll see that we have session 1, 2, and 3 now. I should sort that by session number by default, probably. And then I've got those records imported into AX. So inside my POS database, I have a number of transactions that I've run, and then I've created 1-RPF, 2.RPF, and 3.RPF. So what we do in that table, we call it the table replication log, and this is in every channel database. And what happens is async client will check to see which tables that is being are being requested by the P job, and that was when we synced the metadata into that job table. So async client will go and say, I have these tables, and by default it's 33 tables that get replicated up into AX, and it'll say, I need to get what you think is the most recent records from those tables. When the RPF file is generated then by the async client and uploaded into AX, it will write to this table replication log, and it'll tell exactly which records, based on that replication counter from origin field, which records are part of that RPF file. So if you were to look at this, you'll see that the upload session ID, the table name, the filter field name, which by default is replication counter from origin for all other tables, and then the filter min and filter max, these are the records then that are part of this particular upload session. So I'm just going to filter that by retail transaction sales trans. So you'll see then for packet 1, the RPF file that generated had the AX retail transaction sales trans records from 0 to 5. For the second packet, it was records 6 through 11. And for the third package, it was 12 through 19. When the AX async client will then run for the next time, it will look at this table, and it will look at that filter max for each table. So for instance, the retail transaction sales trans table, and it'll say, what is the highest record that that's already been uploaded to the async server. So it'll run this statement on each of the tables, and it'll say, I have uploaded records from 0 through 19 at some point in time, and the next time that I run my upload session, I'm going to start with values 20 and higher. If I don't have anything to upload for a particular table, or if all, or excuse me, only if there's no records in any of the tables to upload any data, we don't write any records to this. So one of the questions that we had come up was, what is the performance implications of this table? And if this table gets very, very huge, if you're running upload sessions every 10 minutes, for instance, will this table start to get bogged down? And we did some just quick ad hoc calculations. And since the transactions only write records into this table if there are a package file that has information in it, this table will probably not get very large in most instances. The other nice thing is that if for some reason you have to start your database over, which was a very difficult thing to do in R2 and previous, we would sometimes get duplicate problems because the replication counter from origin table is an identity column. And if the AX is in charge of asking for records based on that column value, then if you started your database over, those columns would start over at zero. And it was kind of tricky to get AX to start pulling transactions from zero again instead of the value that it thought it needed to grab. The nice thing about this is if for some reason you have to start with a brand new database, your brand new database will not have a table replication log, so async client will start uploading all the transactions as it should based on the fact that there has been no uploads yet for this particular database. So that makes that problem a lot easier to take care of. The next thing I wanted to quickly talk about is the logging of both the async client and the async server. I'm not going to go into this in too much detail other than to show you how it works. The logging is basically the same as it was in all of our other components. We either log information to the Windows Event Viewer or we log information directly to an XML file. We also have the ability to log information directly to System Center to pull information out. So underneath every async client, there is an async client configuration. And of course I have extensions turned off, so let's turn that on quickly here. So under the async client service.xe.config, if we were to open that up and edit it, you'll see that the familiar logging capabilities exist in here. So we have our trace listeners. There's three now in all of our R3 components. There's the standard XML trace listener that we've had and the event log, and then there's the monitoring tracer as well. We're just going to worry about the rolling XML trace listener by default. And one gotcha is that we actually turn that off by default now in R3 components. So we actually have to uncomment it out, and it's a little bit difficult to see because this XML file is not color-coded based on properties. And in looking at this one a little closer, I don't think that the rolling XML trace listener is commented out. So what we want to do then is we'll just take a look at what happens in this log file if we turn it all the way up to the highest level. So we'll go ahead and turn that to all. And then if you remember correctly from previous versions, the initialized data is where we're able to tell it where to log the information to. If we save it as a .svc log extension, it will automatically open in our little viewer tool, so I like to do that. And I'll just want to confirm that the temp directory exists, and hopefully the async client user will have access to that. Now, in order to make any of the changes to the config file, we need to recycle the service. And hopefully, if things work correctly, after recycle the service, we'll start seeing some information in the temp folder, which we don't. So I'm going to pause the recording and see if I can determine why that's not logging. I think the reason was that I didn't actually save the notepad file. So here you'll see that we have the async client.00 service log file that's been created. And if we were to have that in a machine, I don't believe I have Visual Studio installed on this machine. So let's actually look at it from within our AX client machine, which I think I have Visual Studio there. So we'll go ahead and look at our Seattle C:\ drive. Yeah, you'll see that I have the service trace listener installed on here. So the sync service is stopped and restarted, and I believe the other XML file is what we actually want. Sometimes it helps to make a copy of these because the files are actually in use. And you'll see that that file is actually, even though it shows as 0 kilobytes, it actually is being written to. And as you can see, it's also being written to pretty frequently. And I'm going to show you a little bit about how chatty this is. I'm going to go ahead and name that, since it's just a temporary file, SVC log as well. You'll see that the service was started correctly and that it is starting to work. So the first thing that we do is when we launch, we check the interval timers. And then what we do is we execute a upload session and a download session. So you'll see that we requested download sessions. There are no download sessions that have been sitting out there ready for us to download because I don't have my scheduler up running batch jobs. But then you'll see that it also starts looking for an upload session. So here it gets pretty chatty about determining which records need to be uploaded. You'll see that it goes through all 33 tables and determine which records it thinks it needs to upload. You'll see the retail transaction sales trans table, which we were looking at earlier, shows that the minimum value that we want to upload is the 19 value. So what's going on here is the async client then has gone out and looked and saw that it has to look for records that are higher than 19. I happen to know that we don't have any transactions yet. So it will say we tried to create an upload session, but we don't have any download, any data to upload. So we're just not going to create one. Then you'll see that we pause for the full minute here. So a minute goes by and we start all over again. We do the download sessions and then we do our upload sessions, and we're still looking at the same log table to see if there's any new records that need to be uploaded. And once again, there was no data to upload. If we were to go ahead and do a couple more transactions, and cycle the service, we'll see if we have a new log file that's been generated in there. And we'll see if there's been enough time passed by on this one to actually show any more information as far as the upload packet. And there was. So it determined that there was a new upload session that had information that needed to be uploaded. So you'll see it created a new uploaded session called 4. And then it created that upload session with some information about the package file that it created. It creates a nice little checksum for us. And it sends that file up to the server. And then it gives some information that the server successfully received that information. So as you can see, the logging is very chatty. Inside the async client. The async server logging is the same, and I will go ahead and pause the recording and get that set up. Now you'll see that I've logged over to the CDX async server package folder. This is under program files and not under inetpub, and the logging information is in our web config folder. So we'll try and open this up in Visual Studio and see if that takes a while or not. And this is where I was talking about. In some of our config files, we've actually commented out the rolling XML writer tracer listener. It took us a while. We couldn't figure out why our tracing wasn't working. So I'll go ahead and uncomment that out. And then we will change the value of that one to be all as well. So the rolling XML trace listener, we'll tell it to save it in our C:\temp directory. Let's just make sure we have a C:\temp directory on this machine. And we're looking for the initialized data on that. Now, I don't think the SVC log trick works on async server because it's running as a web service and it needs to append the process identifier, but we'll give it a shot. We'll see here. I believe that usually with web config files, we don't have to recycle the service. It will automatically reread that. It'll detect that the web config file changed. But let's go ahead and cycle our async client just so we can make sure that a session was initiated from somewhere. And let's go back and see if we have anything in our temp directory. And we do. We'll see the async server.00.svc log. And you'll be able to see, based on the sessions, now these are broken down by different activities here, but you'll see that the Houston user logged in properly. It's doing the download and upload for that. It's updating our heartbeat for the channel database. And hopefully there'll be some Seattle stuff in here too. Yeah, you'll see that we have the checking the authentication with our Seattle user. And then checking for the download sessions and upload sessions to see if there's anything to download. And at this point in time, we don't have anything to either upload or download. So you'll see the logging for the AX async client is not nearly as chatty as the async, or excuse me, for the async server is not nearly as chatty as the async client. The last quick thing I want to show is how the segregation of data works based on whether you have records in a particular data group or not. Whether you have a channel database assigned to the same data group or different data group. Inside our Seattle database, for instance, if I go and look at the retail staff table, you'll see that we have 12 records in the retail staff table. Now, the way that this works with this particular job that's running against this table is that it will detect every staff ID that's assigned to any address book that's assigned to a channel that is part of the data group. So that's a long way of saying that the staff ID that end up in this table should be the ones that are assigned to either the Seattle store or the Houston store. Now that's fine in some of the tables. The staff ID is a pretty small table. It's not necessary to really segregate data too much at that level. But if you have very disparate types of information between the stores, for instance, if you have an entire chain of stores that has completely different inventory than another chain of stores, you might want to have that inventory be only set to those groups of stores. And in order to achieve that, what you have to do is just create different data groups for the different stores. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go and take the Houston data group, or excuse me, the Houston store, and we're going to move that into a different data group. So let's go ahead and go into our channel data groups, and we'll create a new one. We'll just call this one South. We'll stay with our R3, and we'll actually share the working folders, because I mentioned this earlier, but the working folders are smart enough to actually segregate the data based on the rec IDs of the data groups. So we won't have to worry about interspersing RPF files. So then I'm going to go, remember we go to our channel database is how we assign to the actual stores or to the data groups. So we'll go into our Houston database and we'll just change that to our new South data group. And then I'm going to run a full data sync on both of the data groups so that we'll clear out all the data in the POS database and reinsert data based on those records. So I'm going to go ahead and pause the recording and I'll get those running and let those complete, and then we'll double check the retail staff table and see if our records are different based on the fact that we have two different data groups. Okay, now that I did the full data sync for both the Houston database and the Seattle database, we can go and check that table again. We'll start in the Seattle database. And I've already run it while we were paused. And as you can see, we have seven rows Let's take a look. There's a couple overlaps between Houston and Seattle since you can have a worker that is assigned to multiple stores, but you'll see here we've got 150, 154, and 155 for instance. And now if we go over to the Houston database and execute the same query, you'll see that we don't have all the 150s. We've got a couple 160s that weren't in the other one. So just by the nature of having the two different channel databases assigned to different data groups, we are able to easily split up the records that are passed back and forth to the final databases. And that means you'll be able to segregate your data and really minimize the amount of data that has to transfer back and forth across the wire. So that's all I have on the async service and async client. Hopefully this will give you some tips and tricks to get everything started, and hopefully you'll have success moving forward with this great new feature in AX for Retail R3.